So, Levitt, you're a fairly successful fellow.
Thank you.
I'm just curious, have you succeeded at everything you've ever done?
No, I've mostly failed at everything I've ever done.
Particulars, please?
Well, definitely golf. Golf has been a lifelong failure. You know, when I was a kid, all I wanted to be was a professional golfer. And thank God that I was so bad at golf that I couldn't even imagine trying to be a pro golfer. I think one of the worst lives you can have in some sense in a modern world is thinking you're good enough to play pro golf, not being good enough to play pro golf, struggling for a decade or 20 years, and then you got nothing to show for it. Mm. But luckily I was so bad I couldn't even pretend to follow that path.
Now, you also failed at becoming the kind of economist that you thought you should become when you first started studying economics, right?
Yeah, I started out as a macroeconomist wannabe, and very quickly I realized that modern macro is all about solving dynamic optimization models, so it was hopeless. Then I wanted to be an economic theorist, and I actually, that was more dangerous because I was almost good enough. I actually was able to publish some papers that were pretty good in pretty good journals. But the thing that saved me on being a microeconomist is actually a funny story, which is that one of my advisors at MIT, I walked into his office and he said, "So what have you been working on, Dave?" Okay. Now, any normal person would have said, "Oh, actually, my name is Steve," but I didn't do it. And he called me Dave for literally weeks and months. It got so bad that at the annual party of the faculty and students, I gathered around all of my friends. I said, "Look, he's going to call me Dave. Just don't worry about it." And finally, it was not that I thought I couldn't be a theorist. It was that I was so embarrassed and traumatized by the idea that at some point I was going to have to say to my main advisor that my name was actually Steve, not Dave, after 6 months of pretending, that I decided I should just forget about theory and go do something different.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Steve Levitt is my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago. As he sees it, it is important to quit things that aren't working out so that you can move on to a better opportunity. But why are so many people so reluctant to quit? One reason is that we tend to equate quitting with failure, and there's a huge stigma attached to failure. But should there be? In our book, Think Like a Freak, we make the argument that perhaps we're not thinking clearly about failure. Maybe failure can be your friend.
I always tell my students, fail quickly. The quicker you fail, the more chances you have to fail at something else before you eventually maybe find the thing that you don't fail at.
Here's the thing. When failure is stigmatized, demonized, people will try to avoid it at all costs, even when it represents nothing more than a temporary setback. Steve Levitt, he does some consulting on the side. He tells a story about one of his earliest consulting jobs with a big multinational retailer.
This was a firm, like many firms, that had a very particular culture, and this was a culture in which if you ever said anything bad about the firm or the prospects of the firm, you were a culprit. You were not a team player.
This firm was about to open its first store in China, in Shanghai. It was a pretty big deal, and for all kinds of reasons, it was really important that the store open on time. So about 2 months before the scheduled opening, the CEO summoned the leaders of the seven teams that were involved in the store's opening, and he asked each of them for a detailed status report. All the reports were positive. Then the CEO asked all seven team leaders to pick one of three signals, green light, yellow light, or red light, to show how confident they were that the Shanghai store would indeed open on time. All seven went with the green light.
Everyone was so excited. They were completely on track for this opening 2 months later. Now, there was a very smart set of people at this firm who completely understood how this culture, while helpful in some ways, was potentially detrimental in others. So they had set up an internal prediction market. And they wanted people to be able to express their true opinions. And the market, the sort of prediction market, is a great way to get people to tell you the truth because it's anonymous and because there are actual incentives, money incentives tied to it. And it's fun because people like to win. It was a competition to see who could amass the most money by buying and selling securities that were tied to the outcome of the firm.
And unlike a stock market, which is not supposed to allow insider knowledge, this is actually the opposite, right? In a firm, you're trying to get the best knowledge you can from people who actually are working on the project.
Exactly.
Right?
The firm had put this internal prediction market into place exactly with the hope that they could learn the truth about what was going on because they weren't sure they were learning it otherwise.
This prediction market offered one bet on whether the Chinese store would open on time. Now, considering that all seven team leaders involved in the opening had given it the green light, you might think that everybody at the company would be bullish. They weren't. The company's internal prediction market showed a 92% chance that the store wouldn't open on time. So guess who was right? The anonymous bettors in the prediction market or the team leaders who had to stand in front of their bosses?
So even though the seven teams had all said we're sure we're on track, everybody basically knew almost for sure that there was almost no chance the store would open on time. And indeed, the store did not open on time.
What does that say about these seven team leaders who had to present to the CEO and their fear of failure? Was it fear of failure? Or was it just fear of appearing that they're not doing their job well? How does failure factor in?
Well, you know, it's funny because in this case, failure can be defined in different ways. I mean, ultimately, they failed. The store did not open. Could you pin that failure on any individual? Not really, but it's tricky because the incentive, and we've talked so much about incentives over the years and what kind of incentives. I mean, obviously there were some financial incentives associated with their jobs, but that wasn't it. I think that what really was most costly is for you to stand up in the room and be the only one willing to say, I'm really sorry, and I know we've been planning this launch for 5 years, but we botched it and we're not going to make it. But there was no place for that.
So it's easy, especially from a distance, to criticize the seven team leaders who told their CEO that they were sure the store would open on time. From the sound of it, this CEO had what is called go fever. You ever heard of go fever? That is a phrase associated with NASA having to do with rocket launches. When a boss catches go fever, it can take a lot of courage to focus on potential failures. Just think of all the factors working against you. There's momentum, institutional politics, ego, and the consequences of go fever can be far more tragic than the delayed opening of a retail shop in Shanghai.
This is shuttle launch control at T-minus 2 hours, 28 minutes and counting. Here comes the 51L flight crew boarding the elevator, ready to depart the ONC building for the launch pad.
On January 28, 1986, NASA was planning to launch the space shuttle Challenger from Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral, Florida. The mission had drawn massive public interest, largely because the crew included a civilian, a schoolteacher from New Hampshire named Krista McAuliffe.
Well, I am so excited to be here. I don't think any teacher has ever been more ready to have two lessons in my life.
The launch had already been delayed a few times. On the night before the new launch date, NASA held a long teleconference call with engineers from Morton Thiokol. That's the contractor that built the Challenger's solid rocket motors.
Okay, well, I'm Alan McDonald.
McDonald was one of the Thiokol engineers on site in Cape Canaveral.
At the time, I was the director of the Space Shuttle Solid Rocket Motor Project for my company, Morton Thiokol.
It was unusually cold in Florida.
There is a meteorologist in Orlando that's saying that these strong winds we saw today are being followed by extreme cold front moving toward the Cape, and they're expecting to see temperatures maybe as low as 18 degrees Fahrenheit by tomorrow morning at the opening of our launch window. And I says, good grief. I says, I'm really concerned that our O-ring seals and these big joints will operate properly at those kind of temperatures.
These O-ring seals kept the extremely hot gases, like 6,000 degrees hot, from escaping the shuttle boosters. You do not want those gases to escape the shuttle boosters.
But as McDonald later described in his book, Truth, Lies, and O-Rings, the boosters had never been tested below 53 degrees, and the forecast for launch morning was calling for temperatures much lower than that. So, on that teleconference call, the night before the launch, McDonald and his team recommended that the launch be postponed again.
And NASA immediately challenged the basis for such a recommendation, which really surprised me, because prior to that time, I had given every flight readiness review for every flight since I had was put on the program. And I was challenged at every one of them of making sure that I could say it was safe enough to flight. And here, all of a sudden, we recommended not flying, and they challenged the basis for that.
McDonald couldn't believe that NASA wanted to launch, despite what he saw as an obvious risk.
I was amazed that they made such statements, because we always erred on the side of safety. In fact, the engineers got put into a position to prove that it would fail, and they could not do that. And that's a whole different question.
According to McDonald, his boss back at Morton Thiokol headquarters in Utah got off the NASA conference call for about 30 minutes to talk about the situation with other Thiokol executives. When he got back on the line, McDonald says, the recommendation to postpone the launch had been reversed. McDonald was angry, but he'd been overruled. The launch was back on. Now NASA requested that the responsible Morton Thiokol official sign off on the decision to launch.
I knew who that responsible Thiokol official was. That was me. That was my job. That was my responsibility. That's why I was where I was at. And I did the smartest thing I ever did in my entire lifetime. And that was I refused to sign the launch recommendation. As a result of that, my boss had to sign it and send it down to me.
Which he did by fax machine. As the engineers were waiting for the fax, McDonald spoke up again.
So then I got more frustrated, and I says, well, let me tell you something. I certainly hope nothing happens tomorrow. But if it does, I'm not going to be the person to stand before a board of inquiry and explain why I gave you permission to fly these solid rocket motors in a condition that I knew they were never qualified to do.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, you know what happens the next morning, don't you?
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
The only thing I saw flying were the solid rocket boosters. They were still going. Everything else had disappeared in this huge explosion cloud in teeny pieces.
And what if you could learn how you might fail without going to the trouble of actually failing?
So lean back in your chair, get yourself calm and just a little bit dreamy. I don't want any daydreaming, but I just want you ready to be thinking about things.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, Alan McDonald was the director of the Space Shuttle Solid Rocket Motor Project for Morton Thiokol, the company working with NASA on the Challenger shuttle launch. The night before the launch, McDonald recommended the launch be delayed out of concern that the shuttle's O-ring seals might fail in the unseasonably cold Florida weather. But McDonald was overruled. The next morning, he walked to launch control.
Carrying my briefcase in one hand, my headset in the other, and it was like 22 degrees, and I saw these icicles hanging all over the place, and I said to myself, they obviously aren't going to launch this thing today. And I was amazed they finally came on and said they were going to send a team, an ice team out, to see if they could knock the ice down as much as possible to reduce the debris risk. And they did that. They ended up doing that actually twice before they finally went into the terminal count and launched the Challenger.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6. We have main engine start.
And I remember I held my breath.
3, 2, 1, and liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Velocity 2,900 feet per second, altitude 9 nautical miles, downrange distance 7 nautical miles.
73 seconds later to see this thing blow up in the sky. I was in shock. I said, it blew up. My heart sank just like everybody in that control room, and I could hear people sobbing in the background.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
And I kept hearing this voice over the network saying, RTLS, RTLS, which is return to launch site, and not getting response back from the orbiter. The only thing I saw flying were the solid rocket boosters. They were still going. Everything else had disappeared in this huge explosion cloud in teeny pieces.
We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded. Flight director confirms that. We are looking at checking with the recovery forces to see what can be done at this point.
No way they could have survived that, in my opinion. And they didn't, obviously.
At that point, McDonald says, the cause of the explosion was unknown.
We're told to not copy anything off the screen. They were all frozen. They locked the doors. They cut all the telephone lines so nobody could talk to anybody. They held the meeting saying that all the data would be considered secret. And really wasn't until the next day that I really realized what had happened.
In the days after the accident, McDonald says, a review of the data showed the cause of the explosion to be what he had feared might happen. The O-rings failed to hold their seal in the cold temperature.
That's exactly what happened.
This cause was later made official by a presidential commission to which Alan McDonald contributed testimony. In the televised portion of the hearings, the physicist Richard Feynman famously demonstrated the cause of the failure by dropping the O-rings into some ice water.
Oh, I took the stuff that I got out of your seal and I put it in ice water. And I discovered that when you put some pressure on it for a while and then undo it, it maintains, it doesn't stretch back, it stays the same dimension. In other words, for a few seconds at least, and more seconds than that, there's no resilience in this particular material when it's at a temperature of 32 degrees. I believe that has some significance for our problem.
Now, of course, Alan McDonald already knew that, or at least that's what he was worried might happen. And that's what makes the Challenger explosion so remarkable and even more tragic than it was. The people in the know, at least some of them, had foreseen the exact cause of the failure. So why, even with that warning, did NASA push on?
What really happened was typical, I think, in large bureaucratic organizations and in any big organization where you're frankly trying to be a hero in doing your job. And NASA had two strikes against it from the start, which one of those is they were too successful. They had gotten by for a quarter of a century now and never lost a single person going to space, which was considered a very hazardous thing to do. And they had rescued the Apollo 13 halfway to the moon when part of the vehicle blew up. Seemed like it was an impossible task, but they did it. So how could this cold O-ring cause a problem when they had done so much over the past years to be successful? So it gives you a little bit of arrogance you shouldn't have, and huge amount of money involved. But they hadn't stumbled yet, and they just pressed on. So you really had to, quote, prove that it would fail, and nobody could do that.
You might think it's a rare case when a group of decision makers know with such precision just what will go wrong with the project, but is it? What if there were a way to peek around the corner on any project to see if it's destined to fail? That is, if you could learn how you might fail without going to the trouble of actually failing. I'd like you to meet Gary Klein.
I'm a cognitive psychologist. I got my PhD back in 1969 in experimental psychology.
Klein's most recent book is Seeing What Others Don't, The Remarkable Ways We Gain Insights. He studies decision-making, especially how people make decisions in real settings, like the Challenger launch.
The Challenger incident has been intensely studied and serves as a wonderful object lesson. And what we saw here was repression of consequences that you didn't want to have to deal with because it would have been so inconvenient.
So we make the argument in our book that there's a general reluctance to quit or to untangle ourselves from projects or relationships or whatnot, and that that's in part because failure is seen as such a stigma. We don't want to quit because we don't want to be seen as having failed. And so let's talk first of all about the stigma of failure. Do you think it deserves it, or do you think we should rethink the way we consider failure generally?
Well, the standard line is that you fail often to get smarter, and you fail in productive ways, and it's a way of building mental models, and all of those things are true.
So how can failure be made more fruitful? Gary Klein has one idea, which I think is pretty brilliant. It's called the premortem. You have surely heard of a postmortem. That's the process by which you figure out what exactly killed, say, a hospital patient or maybe a big project. Theoretically, everybody benefits from the knowledge you gather during a postmortem.
Everybody except the patient, because the patient is dead. The idea of a premortem is to try to run through that process before the patient dies.
But the patient in this case, we should say, is not a human, but it's a project or a product or something like that, correct?
Exactly.
With a premortem, you try to find out what might go wrong before it goes wrong. How does this work? Gary Klein will walk us through it. Imagine you work for a company that's about to launch some big project that you and a lot of others have been working on for months, maybe years. But before you launch, Klein gathers all the important team members in a room.
I need you to be in a relaxed state of mind. So lean back in your chair. Get yourself calm and just a little bit dreamy. I don't want any daydreaming, but I just want you ready to be thinking about things. And I'm looking in a crystal ball, and oh gosh. The image in the crystal ball is a really ugly image. See, this is a 6-month effort. We are now 3 months into the effort, and it's clear this project has failed. There's no doubt about it. There's no way that it's going to succeed. Oh, and I'm looking at another scene a few months later. Project is over, and we don't even want to talk about it. And when we pass each other in the hall, we don't even make eye contact. It's that painful. Okay, so this project has failed, no doubt about it. Now, for the next 2 minutes, and I'm going to time this, for the next 2 minutes, I want each of you to write down all the reasons why this project has failed. We know it failed, no doubts. Write down why it failed. I keep a strict clock because we don't want to chew up too much time on this. And I see everybody is writing, and I say there's 20 seconds to go, and they're writing faster because they're trying to get everything in. And now 5 seconds, and then, okay, finish the sentence, and then pencils up.
Now Klein would go around the room and ask for one item from each person's list, and they compile a catalog of all the ways the project might fail. Klein calls this prospective hindsight. And what does it accomplish?
It really reduces overconfidence. And people are usually way too confident at the beginning of a project. So the premortem tempers that overconfidence.
Now Klein would ask everyone in the room to think up one thing they could do to help the project.
And then we go around the room to see what people are planning to do that they hadn't thought of before to try to make it more successful.
So you put a happy ending on a potentially sad story.
Exactly. That's what we're trying to do, without sugarcoating the problems that face us.
Now,
Now, here's an obvious question. If you are running a pre-mortem and everybody involved with the project is able to come up with a few ways in which the project might fail, why are these potential problems only coming up now when the project is about to launch? Gary Klein says that's because the pre-mortem liberates people who might otherwise be afraid of looking like they're not a team player. Because now everybody's being asked to think about failure. So instead of looking like a bad teammate, you are pulling in the same direction as everybody else.
Now the demand characteristic is, show me how smart you are. Show me how clever you are and how experienced you are by identifying things that we need to worry about.
I'm curious to know how well the pre-mortem is catching on, because I feel like whenever I describe it to a group of people, small or large, they're blown away by it. They love the idea, and very few of them have heard of it. So I'm curious, for an idea that sounds so great and sounds so practical, why hasn't it taken over the world a bit more?
That's very kind of you. I'm not entirely sure. I think one reason is we have not gone out of our way to publicize it. This was just a kind of activity that grew up out of our own practice, and we were just doing it internally. And after we would do it with a few project managers, sponsors, and they said, can you use it with some of our other projects, even though you're not involved? So I sort of see it the other way. I'm surprised at how many people are using it. I hear about people using it, and nobody ever mentioned it to me. So I'm impressed that it's gotten as much mileage as it has.
I went back to Steve Levitt with a couple of questions. Why do you think there's such a stigma associated with failure generally?
I think to be willing to accept failure, you have to have self-confidence. That you have to be accepting of the idea that failing doesn't define who you are. Failing gets something out of the way that keeps you from finding the thing that you're actually going to be good at. And I mean, look, we're spoiled, right? You and I both have stumbled onto a lot of success, and it's so much easier to be terrible at things and to admit you're terrible when in other parts of your life you get rewarded and people, you know, write you letters and say you're great. So I think it's easy for us to accept failure. And honestly, you know, I think I've gotten much better as I've gotten older at being able to laugh at myself. I was really insecure for a long time. I didn't want to show people I was bad. But now I think I've actually gotten, I mean, I often will laugh the hardest. When I do stupid things, I laugh the hardest.
So what's the strategy if you're the CEO or if you're another CEO, even if you're the CEO of a two-person operation listening to this, what is the strategy to encourage people to acknowledge that failure may happen and that we'd be much better off dealing with the failure beforehand than after?
I think the only credible way to make failure acceptable is to celebrate failure. I know at my little firm, TGG, The Greatest Good, we had our greatest failure actually turned out to be our greatest success, I think, in terms of morale building when I got asked to give a speech to one of our clients. And I told the truth in that speech. And it led to our being fired the very next day. The executives of the company, it turned out, weren't that interested in hearing the truth. And unceremoniously, through email, we were fired from one of our biggest accounts. And the thing was that we celebrated it, not just pretend celebrated, we really celebrated it because our view was there's no point in staying up all night working on projects for clients if they don't appreciate it. If they don't want to hear the truth, then how in the world do we want to spend our life doing this work? And what happened was the people at our little firm, I think they would have thought we'd be upset. We couldn't have been happier. And we broke out beer and wine and we celebrated the fact that one of the biggest companies in the world had decided to fire us because we told the truth. And I think, you know, one of the things that you and I have really come to believe over time is that it's really not for most people about money. There's something bigger that if you're going to work hard and do something, it's about the pride and the joy of feeling like you're part of something bigger, something exciting. And the folks who worked at our little consulting firm actually felt that day that it was about something bigger, that we were about the truth. We were about, you know, doing good work. And that's hard to do in a business setting. But it was, you know, I don't know, I want to get all misty at it, but it's kind of magical.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on from failure, there's nothing magical about money, is there? Steve Levitt and I are both parents, and I wanted to hear what he thought about teaching kids how to best think about money. So, Levitt, let me ask you this. Your oldest kids and mine are about the same age, so in 5, 6, 7 years, we're going to be sending them off to college, hopefully. What's the financial or spending advice you give your kids going out in the world for the first time? With maybe you give them a debit card, a credit card, you load them up with cash. How do you teach them about money in the real world?
You know, I care so little about money, and I've always cared so little about money, and I've never really wanted anything, that I've certainly started as a parent to basically tell kids that nothing's really worth anything and you don't really need anything. And so hopefully my kids will go into the world putting almost no value on material possessions. Okay, but maybe I fail at that. But if I succeed at that, then there's really no lesson about anything. You give them the credit card, they don't want anything. If they're in a jam, they use it. Now, on the flip side, I've also probably spoiled my kids by giving them what they want because they don't really want anything. And so my kids probably have almost no understanding of the meaning of a dollar and what hard work entails. So I don't know. I think my kids might be in trouble. One of the best pieces of financial advice I ever got was from a senior economist at Chicago when I got here named Jose Shankman. What he told me is actually something that he said Milton Friedman told him. And what he said was, you should spend more and save less. Because I think what happens to young people is young people are always told to be thrifty, to save, save, save. But Jose's point was this. Look, you're never going to be poorer than you are today. I mean, this was when I was a first-year professor at the University of Chicago. Your salary will only go up. Your earning power will only go up. And so you shouldn't be saving now. You should be borrowing. You should be living today in much the way you'll be living in 10 or 15 years. And it's crazy to actually be scrimping and saving, which is what at least someone like me who was brought up in a middle-class family was taught to do. And, you know, there was a time, I remember for many years, where I would refuse to buy anything in an airport out of the sense that it was too expensive, you know, that it was frivolous to buy a soda in the airport for $3. And then eventually I said, well, no, that's crazy. I'm going to give myself the freedom to anything below $5. I'm just not going to worry about it. If something is below $5 and I want it, I'm just going to buy it. And over time, that number has gone up and up and up. And I mean, obviously you and I had some success with the books and stuff. So we have more money than we thought we would have. But just in general, I think so often young people don't consume as much as they should. And they end up, you know, really scrimping and saving and wasting tons of time. I mean, if you think about how people will spend hours and hours to save a few dollars, it makes no sense, right? If you have any value on your time, you shouldn't go across town.
Can I just say, so this advice sounds like some of the worst advice I've ever heard, except maybe in your very narrow situation, because what you're leaving out there is that you've already made a massive investment in your education, and now your investment is starting to pay off returns and dividends and basically an annuity. But not everybody's in that situation. In fact, most people are not in that situation, right? So you had basically turned yourself into a walking human annuity by the time you were, whatever, 27, 28 years old, unless you totally screwed up. And knowing that, I can see why you might want to consume more than you had been conditioned to do so. But absent those facts, you don't want to do what you're describing, or do you? In other words, a lot of people now, they get a first good job at, let's say, 24, 25, 28, 30. Do they have the sense that you would have had as a young academic of that age that they're just going to be on an upward trend? I think most people don't feel that.
So the actual question you asked had to do with your kid going off to college. So college students, people who are going to graduate from college are never poorer than they are in college, mm-hmm. assuming their parents aren't helping them much. Mm-hmm. Okay? And if you look at the overall earnings trajectory of college graduates, it goes up for 25, 30 years before it starts going down. Yeah. Yeah. So in general, what I'm saying is true, that, mm-hmm. that people get richer over the life cycle. And so what we expect they should do is that they should not save when they're young. they should start saving in their 30s and 40s, and they should dissave when they're in their 60s and 70s. They should run down the savings. So I stand by what I'm saying. I think people are too thrifty, not thrifty enough.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, how the Japanese housing market is very different from ours.
It's one thing if it's about, I don't know, buying shampoo, but it's not. This is like people's biggest investment in their lives. And the Japanese are basically throwing it all away.
That's coming up on Freakonomics Radio. And for more episodes like this one, check out our podcast archive on Freakonomics.com, where you'll also find our books, the blog, and more.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
So, let's say you're an architect, and what you really like to design is single-family houses. Houses with flair, with distinctive, maybe even avant-garde features, and you want to design houses that will actually get built. So, if that's who you are, then for you, utopia might be Japan.
So they make a very, very weird-looking or avant-garde looking houses.
Well, it's hard to describe, but
quite avant-garde, radical design.
Strange-looking, weird-looking.
Living in the home is like climbing around a jungle gym or Matrix.
One of them was about four or five stories, but one wall was cut in such a way that the floor space at the fifth level was bigger than fourth and the third and the second. And it looked very unstable. Of course, it's highly eye-catching.
Okay, so if you are an architect, not only can you go wild with the design of Japanese houses, but even more important, there's a lot of work.
There's a huge demand for new homes.
Jiro Yoshida specializes in real estate economics at Penn State University. He used to work on the same issues for the Japanese government.
So on the per capita basis, the number of architects in Japan is 3.8 times greater than in the United States.
There are, in fact, more registered architects per capita in Japan than any other country. Not so surprisingly, there are a lot of construction jobs, too.
And so in Japan, the construction employment as a percentage of the total population is 2.1 times greater than in the United States.
So let's add this up. A lot of construction jobs, a lot of architects, and a huge demand for creatively designed homes. So that sounds like your pretty typical housing boom, yeah?
I think you have to dig deeper than that.
Alistair Townsend is an architect in Japan. And as he'll tell us today, the story of home building there has an unusual wrinkle.
It's just such a profound and huge thing, and it doesn't seem to occur this way in any other country in the world. And so I'm genuinely, even though I know a lot about the topic, I'm still sort of baffled.
Now, when you hear that phrase, a huge demand for new homes, you probably think it's because of either a booming economy or a growing population or maybe both. But in the case of Japan, there's neither. The economy has been famously stagnant for more than two decades, and the Japanese population has been shrinking and continues to do so. It's expected to decrease another 30% by 2060. So what does this mean for housing? Japan has an abnormally high vacancy rate, estimated to be in the mid to high teens. So you'd think, with so many vacant homes, there wouldn't be a lot of new home building. You'd think that if someone was looking to buy a house, they'd simply buy one, maybe freshen it up and move in. But that is not what happens. Here's Jiro Yoshida again.
According to an engineering study, approximately half of houses are demolished before 38 years of building age in Japan.
Okay, did you hear that? Half of all homes are demolished before they're 38 years old.
So basically that is the half-life of housing stock in Japan. So half-life of housing stock in Japan is 38 years. In contrast, the half-life in the United States is approximately 100 years. So that's a huge difference.
So more than 60% of all Japanese homes were built after 1980. Now, why would that be? Again, you might think it's because of a baby boom or a growing economy, but Japan doesn't have either of those. The reason that so many not very old homes in Japan are knocked down seems to be this. They've lost their value.
And in my estimation, the structure fully depreciates after 30 years for detached houses and after 40 years for condominiums. So it's really, really fast.
That's right. A home in Japan loses its entire value after just 30 years, or according to other studies, in as little as 15 years. Now, that's the house itself, not the land, although land values have certainly fallen since their peak. A little quick history here. During the last half of the 1980s, land prices in Japan more than doubled. Richard Koo is chief economist at Nomura Research Institute in Tokyo.
Land prices were so high that just the Imperial Palace Garden in the middle of Tokyo during the bubble days was worth the entire state of California back in 1989.
But that bubble burst and property values have fallen. Jiro Yoshida again.
Since then, housing prices in Japan have been continually decreasing, except for a few years of small appreciation in 2007 and so on. Compared to 1991 price levels, current housing price levels will be probably 40% of the peak.
Okay, so that is a big fall in property values, 40% off the peak prices, but it's not like they fell to zero. That is, however, essentially what happens to the value of the physical house in Japan. There's only a tiny resale market in Japan for used houses. In most cases, when a property is sold, the house is demolished and a new one built. This is in direct contrast to most places, the U.S. in particular, where not only do homes keep their value, but older homes with their colonial charm or brownstone character, they are particularly cherished.
The Japanese are willing to look beyond all of that and just demolish a house, even though it could provide shelter and it could be renovated for a lot less than they would spend building a new house.
Alistair Townsend was born in England, grew up in Iowa, and returned to England to become an architect.
Well, I met my wife, who's Japanese, as a student in London, and we worked for a number of years for architects. But since I decided to study architecture, I've always been fascinated by the radical homes that I saw in Japanese architectural magazines.
When they finished their studies in England, they saw that their opportunities would be limited.
We decided to leave London because it's actually very hard to build new housing there as a young architect. Most of the commissions are renovations and refurbishments of existing old houses because the planning system makes it very hard to build new homes, and people value historic homes more than they do new ones. And we moved to Japan in order to get more experience and hopefully build more.
In Japan, Townsend found a huge appetite for new homes.
You see advertisements everywhere on the train and on billboards for new housing, commercials on television, TV programs.
In Townsend's opinion, at least, the fact that Japanese homes don't hold their value changes what people are looking for when they hire an architect.
The economic incentives to build a house that will one day be resold don't exist in Japan because of housing depreciation. And this means that a client is free to build a house according to their own personal preferences and their own idiosyncrasies.
Townsend also thinks that with so many architects in Japan, they are all fighting to stand out in a crowd. Plus which, local governments typically don't regulate neighborhood aesthetics like they do in many countries. So that may help explain all the unusual and avant-garde houses in Japan. But we still haven't answered the more bizarre question. Why are Japanese homes essentially disposable? Jiro Yoshida again.
On this issue, people have many, many casual observations or casual explanations. For example, many people say that Japanese consumers are just different. Japanese consumers just like new things. Okay, for example, the most sacred Shinto shrine is called Issei Jingu.
And this shrine is massive, timber structure, but every 20 years it's torn down and a new identical shrine is built on a plot next to it. And this is something very ingrained within the Japanese psyche, which values newness as something that is spiritually clean and pure.
So maybe the hunger for new homes is a cultural appetite, at least to some degree.
For example, if we take a look at the second-hand or used car market, okay, even used cars are traded really cheaply in Japan compared to other countries. So there's something to it, but it's not the whole thing.
Okay, so what else might explain Japan's disposable housing attitude? Let's go back to World War II. The most famous U.S. attacks on Japan were the atomic bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Both cities were devastated.
This is the gallant crew that rode the big super fort which carried the first atomic bomb to Japan. Piloted by Colonel Paul Tibbets, Jr. of Miami, carrying Navy Captain William Parsons of Chicago, who helped design the bomb as observer, and Major Thomas Farabee of Mocksville, North Carolina, who pulled the plug on Hiroshima, the B-29 dropped its load of atomic death, which exploded with a force equal to 20,000 tons of TNT. A few days later, the second atomic terror was loosed on Nagasaki.
But the U.S. dropped a lot of non-atomic bombs in Japan and a lot of other cities. 5 months before the atomic bombs, more than 300 American B-29s started dropping more than 2,000 tons of incendiary bombs on Tokyo. Most of that city was burned to the ground. 100,000 people were killed, and 1 million people were left homeless.
And after World War II, when everything was flattened by American bombing, they had to rebuild everything very, very quickly.
That's Richard Koo from the Nomura Research Institute.
And at that time, they didn't pay much attention to the quality of houses they were building.
It was certainly the case that after World War II, many of the houses that were built during the boom were shoddily constructed.
Alistair Townsend again.
They lack insulation and are generally very cold. They have heavy tile roofs, which make them a liability in earthquakes. So it's understandable that those houses are being replaced.
So you can see why the first round of homes built in Japan after the war were torn down after not too long, especially as the country started to get richer. But there's another factor that led the Japanese to think of their homes as non-permanent, and that is earthquakes. 20% of the world's earthquakes of magnitude 6 or greater happen in Japan.
And because of that history, Japanese have come to view the houses, building structures in general as kind of perishable because after each earthquake, many of those were destroyed. And so there's a fundamental feeling within the Japanese scheme of things that nothing is permanent.
So that makes sense. And it might help explain why Japanese homes depreciate so much and so fast. But as Jiro Yoshida tells us, there's another earthquake-related explanation.
So the deep question is, why do structures depreciate so fast? And why do people have to demolish these old buildings so soon? And actually, one very simple answer, and in a sense, it's an uninteresting answer to that, is the revisions to the building codes. And revision to the building codes, especially with respect to earthquake resistance standards. Okay, so in the past, the building codes in Japan have been continually revised after major earthquakes.
It began nearly a century ago with what is known as the Great Kanto Earthquake.
And that Great Kanto Earthquake destroyed over 500,000 houses in Tokyo. And that was a huge, huge disaster. And after that Great Kanto Earthquake, the building code introduced an earthquake resistance standard. And then those earthquake resistance standards were updated in 1950 after a Fukui earthquake, in 1971 after Tokachi earthquake, in 1981 after Miyagi earthquake, and in 2000, most latest in 2000, after Hanshin-Awaji earthquake.
So as new earthquake standards were put into place, older buildings were decreed unsafe. When a property was sold, the house would be torn down and a new house put up. But everyone we talked to for this story, Richard Koo, Jiro Yoshida, and Alistair Townsend, they all point out that today, even homes that easily meet earthquake standards are still demolished when they're sold. Many of these homes, Townsend says,
exceed the quality of just about any other country in the world, at least for timber buildings. And so there's really no reason that they should drop in value and be demolished.
So there's no reason, except maybe fear of earthquakes, as rational or otherwise as that fear may be.
I really feel that the risk of earthquakes to single-family homes is very much overstated, and it's partly a way that housing companies, house builders, market their houses by instilling, you know, effectively instilling fear within their prospective customers by making so much of, you know, seismic technology, most of which is redundant. By the time that you have skinned a house with structural plywood, it's sufficiently cross-braced to sustain an earthquake.
So think about this for a minute. If you buy a house and you knock it down to build a new one because you think the old one isn't safe, and if you know that the people who eventually will buy that house from you will do the same, how much money and time do you think you'll invest in taking care of your house? Richard Koo calls this the vicious cycle of the Japanese housing market.
Maybe they will keep the rooms tidy and clean, but externally, I mean, once the house is built, it's never repainted again. And a lot of external things are allowed to dilapidate, deteriorate. And then 20, 30 years, it's all, whole thing is torn down and another one is built in its place. So it's kind of a vicious cycle, right? If you expect the house to last only 20, 30 years, you're not going to put much into maintenance. And as a result, the house really lasts only 20, 30 years.
Alistair Townsend has seen the same lack of maintenance.
But that's nowhere near as developed as in the U.S., where you have massive stores like Home Depot and Lowe's, where people can go and buy every part of the house. And it seems like many people in America are confident to build an extension onto their home or finish the basement or remodel a room. In Japan, that really just doesn't happen, because part of that is there isn't an incentive to maintain the house.
All right, so we've identified at least what seem to be several legitimate reasons for why Japanese houses don't hold their value over time. Now, you might just say that, well, things are different in Japan. It's not necessarily worse. But Richard Koo disagrees. A few years back, he co-authored a paper called Obstacles to Affluence: Thoughts on Japanese Housing. The paper argued that the habit of treating homes as disposable is extraordinarily wasteful and that it has contributed to Japan's long economic slump.
So you tear down the building, you build another one, and tear down the building, you keep on building another one. You're not building wealth on top of wealth. You know, it's a very poor investment compared to Americans or Europeans or even other Asian countries, where people are building wealth on top of wealth because your house is a capital good. And if you do, you know, a certain amount of maintenance, you can expect to sell the house at the higher price. But in the Japanese case, once you buy it, you expect to sell at a lower price 10, 15 years later. And that's no way to build an affluent society.
So we've come full circle. At the beginning of this story, when we heard about the huge demand in Japan for new houses and architects, we might have assumed an economic boom was the cause. But not only isn't there a boom, the ongoing slump, at least according to Richard Koo, may have been caused in part by Japanese attitudes toward the housing market. Now, if you're an American or a Brit who suffered during the housing hysteria of the past decade or so, the idea of not locking up all your wealth in a house might be appealing. But the opposite of hysteria is not necessarily utopia. It may, in fact, be its own sort of madness, which Alistair Townsend even after 6 years in Japan, still can't comprehend.
Okay, it's one thing if it's about, I don't know, buying shampoo, but it's not. This is like people's biggest investment in their lives. And the Japanese are basically throwing it all away.
Stephen Dubner, thanks for listening today. You can find all our Freakonomics Radio podcasts at Freakonomics.com or iTunes. You can also reach us at radio@Freakonomics.com. And you can find us on Twitter, Facebook. Talk to you next week.